Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Livingston, and this is where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page, Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to empower and inspire a community of people who take every opportunity to live a high-performing life. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com. Reconditioning is about helping you capture the power of therapeutic practice and performance practice in one integrated system. More and more today, reconditioning professionals are becoming sought after in human performance environments everywhere. The RPRO series is a four-step process to becoming a reconditioning professional. The first two are completely online, so you can get started immediately from the comfort of your own home. R1 Foundations is about you learning the building blocks of assessing and improving functional movement. R2 Designs is empowering the process even further, so you can assess and improve any human movement and integrate your work into performance programming. The R3 Collab is about you experiencing the full power of the process in a living lab, troubleshooting your issues, fixing your problems in real time, and gaining real confidence. The R4 Mentorship is about exposing your knowledge, refining your approach, and learning through a powerful feedback process so you can be the reconditioning professional everyone wants to work with. For more information on all our course offerings, including our landmark personal development program, Empower You, please check out reconditioninghq.com today and use the coupon code LYM50 for $50 off any one of our course offerings. I'm excited to have my friend Brad Thorpe and his company ISOFIT involved with the Leave Your Mark podcast. His mission is the same as mine, helping human beings live better lives. He doesn't want to see you let an injury force your retirement from the sport or activity you love. For decades, physiotherapists, athletic therapists, and chiropractors have recommended isometric strength training to help speed up rehabilitation from injury and included it in return to sport protocols. I know I use it often in my own reconditioning process. Whether your goal is performance enhancement, injury prevention, or injury recovery, the all-new ISOFIT MSK takes athletes from the therapy room to the podium. To learn more, visit www.isofit, that's ISOFIT with a PHITMSK.ca, and remember to use the discount code LEAVEYOURMARK, three separate words, to save $500 off your ISOFIT MSK purchase. I want to thank Greg Lawler and Matrix Fitness for being a long-standing sponsor of the Leave Your Mark podcast. Matrix is indeed leaving a mark on the fitness and performance industry today. In the last 20 years, Matrix has become a global brand that employs over 7,000 people worldwide and delivers over 500 products catering to the medical, fitness, and athletic performance markets. Matrix has a wide range of programming solutions, and they are dedicated to creating deeper partnerships with their customers everywhere. Matrix has many ways of making a relationship work for you, the customer, and offers rental and various financial incentives to assist the financial constraints of adding premium equipment during this time of inconsistent revenue. For more information and free consultation, go to teamupwithmatrix.com/CA. That's teamupwithmatrix.com/CA today. Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm Scott Livingston, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Todd Wright. Todd is the Vice President of Player Performance and Assistant Coach for the Los Angeles Clippers. He is currently finishing his second season with the Clippers. Before his time with the Clippers, Todd spent 4 years with the Philadelphia 76ers as an assistant coach and head of strength and conditioning. Prior to the NBA, Todd spent 21 years in college basketball and helped his teams reach 19 out of 21 NCAA tournaments, including a span of 17 consecutive trips to the NCAA tournament with teams at Clemson and Texas. Todd had the privilege to coach and help develop many great players in his coaching career. While at Texas, he coached two National Players of the Year winners, TJ Ford and Kevin Durant. Todd founded Train for the Game in 2002, a fitness, sport performance, and physical restoration facility in Austin, Texas, and has also worked with and consulted for Nike Global Basketball, Nike Spark, and the Nike Performance Council. Todd has been speaking nationally on topics of functional performance rehabilitation since 2006, including the training model of the vertical core, functional upright core training that has been featured in Men's Fitness and Experience Life magazine. Todd and his wife, Kate, reside in Manhattan Beach, California, and their two daughters, Hannah and Abigail, and son, Chance. I'm honored to have him on the show today. Welcome, Todd.
Scott, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure, honor. For the listener, we met sort of informally a few years ago at a Perform Better Summit. I think Todd Durkin introduced us actually at breakfast or something at some point and just got to know each other's names. And then we ran into each other again at an event that David Martin and the 76ers were running called the Star Summit a few years back. And I got to sit and actually chat with you, and I did a presentation, and I was really impressed with the human being that you were, and I wanted to reconnect, and we've reconnected. So thanks for taking the time today, buddy.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, man. That was a great, that Star event was a great event. David Martin did a hell of a job, put some great people together. I really enjoyed listening to you talk that day, and you could see and why that you've had the success that you've had in this field, you know, the ability to build great training systems, but the ability to connect with people you could, it was kind of oozing that day that, that you were able to present to us. It was fun for me to listen to you that day.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Today is more about you and, you know, you grew up in Peabody, Mass. So, a good Mass boy. As you're growing up, what is influencing you as a kid? Is it, sports? Is it your parents? Is it school? What are the driving influences that shape you in your youth?
Yeah, you know what? When I was growing up, you know, I was born in 1970, and so, you know, if you grow up in New England, obviously Boston sports they're ingrained in you pretty strong. But there were some really good years in Boston sports as I was growing up. You know, the Bruins were always in division titles in the early 80s, and the Celtics were rolling, and you know, the Patriots, not so much, but the Red Sox, you know, if you've ever been in New England, you know, at nighttime, you're walking out in your neighborhood, every TV through the window has the Red Sox game on. So I grew up and, you know, my father had me in athletics at a real young age, but, you know, I look back to the neighborhood that I grew up in and, you know, we grew up, you know, my backyard was the perfect wiffle ball field, and I had a basket that hung from a gigantic oak tree, and that we had, you know, a floodlight on, and the Ferrani's house next door was perfect. I could put the trash barrels up to, you know, for a goal, you know, for hockey. And then we had a big church behind our house that, you know, as street hockey games got bigger, we could actually play at both ends. And we just had enough kids in the neighborhood that, you know, that were my age or, you know, and my brother was 4 years older than me that, you know, we were playing against kids that were older than us also. You know, so that those were major influences growing up. We played all those sports. And then my father was a truck driver, and he delivered ice cream novelties to small stores. And, you know, look, you know, as you get older, I'm sure you're the same way, Scott, is like you retrospectively look at some of the things that your parents did exceptionally well. And the two things that my father didn't make a lot of money, but they put us in a neighborhood that, that, you know, we had a great structure, great home, but they really invested in education and the house, the home where we were at. And so I went to parochial school, you know, my whole life from, you know, kindergarten. I went to St. John the Baptist. And then when I got out, I ended up at St. John's Prep in Danvers, Massachusetts. But growing up, my father had this truck route. And going to parochial school, you had the first Friday off of every month. And so I was able to jump into his truck, you know, probably second or third grade. And I would, you know, we would go into Boston on Fridays and we would reload his truck. We would, you know, go to this plant that, you know, the forklifts would come out and drop all these novelties off. And he had six doors on this big truck. And, you know, as a young kid, he's, you know, teaching me, you know, put all the pints here, put all the half gallons here, you know, and he's in the truck and I'm handing him one sleeve at a time, you know, at the time. And then you see the evolution to, you know, when I'm in the sixth grade, I'm handing him two or three at a time. And then he's driving me around Boston, you know, like we're going in and out at all these, you know, very diverse neighborhoods. And I'm able to watch my father, who was a great man, and just how he interacts with people. But you're learning what, you know, now I look back, I'm learning these systems at a really young age. And even though it's not, you know, it might not be as totally relevant to the world that I'm leading and working in now, you know, you go in and you organize the freezer and you break the boxes down, and he says, hey, you know, go into the second hole and grab this, you know. And so at a young age, I was starting to learn what these systems look like. But what he instilled in me early was, if you want something, you know, they invested so much money in our education and our home that if we wanted anything outside of that, we were going to have to earn it. Like if I wanted to, we grew up in, you know, Converse sneakers, or I forget the other one, what they were called, but they were all canvas and the blue, you know, the blue streak across the top of it. I'm forgetting, I'm drawing the blank on it, but we would wear those things until, you know, the soles would rip off. And so if we ever wanted something Nike or anything, he's like, go get a job, man. Like, you know, if you want, like, well, I'm working on your truck, ain't that? He's like, no, that ain't, that don't count. So, you know, at an early age, you know, I got a job delivering papers in the seventh grade. And then that grew into, you know, I got a busboy job at Spud's restaurant and started helping out there. And then, you know, worked in an ice house, sold Christmas trees with them, did landscaping, you know, worked for another ice cream company, making the ice cream and delivering the ice cream, you know, worked in a Levi store. And so he was just like, hey man, if you want you, so I started to understand and learn the value of the dollar, you know, and that was a really cool experience for me at that time. And, but when I look back at my time with my father, it really instilled a work ethic with me at a really young age. And, you know, I was just spending time with my pop. And then
remember the first thing that you remember the first thing that you bought with your own money?
I can remember to a T. I bought, and the crazy part is that they just came back out, you know, the old school Nike Blazers, all canvas with the rubber, you know, the rubber cap on the top of the toe. And I remember they were like Carolina blue stripe, and I bought them at Coleman's, and like just how good that felt, you know what I mean? But then like he taught me too, like, hey, you want a car? Like you're paying for it, you know? And I remember my first car was a Toyota Corolla 1979 that it was a 3-speed that we paid $175 for. But I paid for it. And all the other cars that I had through that stretch, you know, I had to, if I wanted it, I had to pay for it. And looking back now, like that, those things at a young age really helped me understand that when I got into coaching, that you were going to have to really earn your stripes and the respect that came with it. But if I wanted to make a livelihood out of it, I was going to have to, you know, work my tail off.
That's awesome. Did you have dreams when you were a kid? Did you sort of look up to something or somebody and say, I want to emulate or be that, or I want to achieve that, so to speak, when you were a kid?
Well, the cool part being in Boston, like every season, you know, like as a kid, this is where, you know, you're watching the Bruins, right? You're watching Rick Middleton and Terry O'Reilly and Mike Milbury and, you know, particular guys that you, and so you go out and you try to emulate how they move, you know, and you'd watch the Red Sox, right? And during that time it was, you know, Fred Lynn, you know, Carl Yastrzemski, you know, Wade Boggs. And so like you'd go outside and you'd bat lefty, you know, for when you wanted to pretend that you were Carl Yastrzemski or Fred Lynn, or, you know, when you were other guys, you know, you get on the right side of the plate. And then, you know, when basketball was rolling. And so like Larry Bird was just, he was in his prime at the time. And I remember I would go out and pretend that, you know, do his free throw shooting routine and rock my feet side to side and load the ball in the same place. And, you know, go downstairs and pretend I was Robert Parrish with my up and under move and Kevin McHale. And
did you go to the Garden to watch games? Did you go when you were a kid?
Oh, you know what? Well, it was so hard to get a ticket when I was growing up, but the majority of the seats at the Garden, I always had the obstructive view. You know, I was always near one of the gigantic pillars, right? But what an amazing building to be in at a young age. And like my father would take me to Fenway Park all the time, and we had the same seats. You know, we would sit on right in the corner of the left field wall where it was the left fielder at the time was Jim Rice. And so we would, you know, we would go to the park early and batting practice. We would hope that guys would, you know, because when you're that close to that edge of the wall, a lot of foul balls would come into that area. So we would go an hour early and I'd catch like three or four, you know, foul balls to be able to bring home and play with. But the Garden was just such a spectacular, you know, being in hockey the way that you were, the fans in Boston, they're very unique. You know,
yeah. Well, I don't usually tell stories on my podcast, but you would appreciate this. When I was in college in the mid '80s, I was a Bruins fan actually growing up, which is kind of ironic. I loved Bobby Orr and I loved the Bruins, and I always cheered for them growing up. And so when I was in college, a buddy of mine who was a Philly fan, Philadelphia Flyers fan, ran into somebody at a Canadiens game, and it turns out this guy was the son of this longstanding season ticket holder for the Garden. His dad had tickets there since it opened. So he knew everybody. So this guy befriended my buddy and he said, well, you ever want to come down to a game, come down. So we did this road trip down to Boston. We drive this sketchy car down to Boston and we roll in and stay in Boston and we go to the game in the Garden. It's my first time in the Garden. And they're playing the Flyers. And I'm trying to remember the goalie's name now for the Flyers, who was a real tough goaltender, nutcase. Anyways, the Bruins start getting down. So we're sitting right behind the Flyers bench and the Bruins are getting down. They're down 4-0. And the goalie, then the Bruins start to come back in the third period. They start scoring. So the goaltender starts taking a stick and just hacking at these guys as they're coming by the net. And all of a sudden, like, play stops because he's just hacked this guy in the legs. And you're in the Garden and all of a sudden all you hear is, and all this stuff comes flying down, paraphernalia from everywhere, beer cups, all this stuff. It was like something you're just like, what the heck?
Yeah, it wasn't Ron Hextall, was it?
Hextall, that's right.
Yeah, Ronnie Hextall. That's right. Yeah. And so I can remember those things, right? Like, I mean, just the, you know, the New York Islanders at that time, like the, you know, Terry O'Reilly and I forget the other guy's name. I think it was Clark. Like they would you were just waiting for them to just go at it, right? The hockey was just, when I was growing up, it was just the physicality to it was just amazing, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, the Garden is, it's a unique.
Special place, yeah.
Yeah, it's a unique place, you know?
So what influences you to decide, well, coming from a working class family, and that's not unusual for a lot of the people that I talk to in the human performance industry, it seems to be an interesting thread, actually, I've noticed, is a lot of guys and gals have teachers as their parents quite often. So Mikey Boyle and different people, their parents were teachers. But I'm curious, what's the influence on your academic life and why do you decide that you're going to, you know, what makes you decide to do what you do in your bachelor's degree?
Yeah. And so, you know what, it's interesting that my father instilled, you know, a lot of the work ethic in me. My mother was really demanding on academics. You know, neither one of them had any college education, but they knew that if we were going to be successful, that it was going to probably be something important for our family. So she was really, really demanding on me, growing up. You know, up till about middle school, school came really easy for me. And then when I grew to be pretty big and strong and much bigger and stronger than most kids my age. And so athletically, you know, when I came home from school, I was out playing. And so academics started to take a little bit of a slide and I had a little bit of action to me as a high schooler. You know, I had some things that, even though that I went to great schools, that I pushed back pretty significantly on people, and I didn't respond very well to discipline or someone that was going to try to help me. And I ran into some trouble in high school, you know, and I was dismissed from some sports teams and that was really hard for me at that time. And it was really well deserved, actually, retrospectively looking. And so I didn't get recruited that well out of high school. But the majority of the, four friends that I had hung out with in high school went on to play Division I football, you know, at low levels, you know, Colgate and Brown and one at Boston College. And so I was going to try to potentially go into prep school for a year. And I sent some tape to a couple schools, Division III schools and Division II schools at the time. And Springfield College happened to be one of them. And there was a coach there that watched the tape, and they called me in, and we went in and interviewed. And at that time, we could get some financial aid because of, you know, my father's, you know, where we stood financially. Or I could go to prep school. I could go to Bridgeton or MCI. And I decided to go to Springfield College, which at the time I didn't realize how good of an education it was for what we're doing now in our lives. It was one of the only schools that it was actually the only school that would accept me. And so I went there to play college football. And at the time I thought I would do economics because my brother, who's 4 or 5 years older than me, was, you know, he graduated from Marquette and he had a real great job with Pepsi at the time. And he was in, you know, the marketing world. So I thought that that's what I would do. And real quickly, I learned that probably wasn't going to be the case. I really struggled in the economics majors and the math and really and truly by accident stumbled into the major that, you know, I got a bachelor's of science in health fitness and it just ended up working out that, you know, I was drawn to the understanding the anatomy and some of the sciences, but I was really into training. Like I was fascinated with, and not till probably my sophomore year in college where I really took it serious enough. And I started to learn sports wise that I couldn't just line up and go make a play, right? Like there were other guys around me and I had to do a particular job. And the first couple of years in college football, I thought I could just go tackle whoever I wanted. And then real quickly, you got coaches saying, well, guess what, buddy? Like, you're not going to play if you don't ride the down block. And if you don't do these jobs, like, we're not playing you. And so the combination of that and then I started to take my physical training really serious. You know, you start to realize the potential of what you have you're optimizing who you are as an athlete, right? And how you start to feel really good about yourself. And I was never a great player, but, you know, I got to play a lot and you could have some impact plays, but how hard you had to work just to contribute to be on the field. Right. And that made me feel really good as a junior and senior in college. And then when I graduated, I was lucky. I was able to move over to get an internship at Boston College. And that was a great experience for me because at the time, BC was really good in football. Tom Coughlin was the head coach and they were out working people. They were out scheming people. You know, they beat Notre Dame and Penn State that year. And it was fun for me to watch, you know, how hard these guys were working. I would set up drill stations at 4:15 in the morning in the winter. And when I got to the building, Tom Coughlin was already there. He was the only one in the building. And you're watching them get these guys up and just how hard they're working on their movement quality, right? But how disciplined when the horn goes, these guys moving from station to station. And at a young coach, you know, I'm 22 at the time, you know, you're really getting into it. From Boston College, I actually, the intern ended and I end up going to bartend and I bartended all through college. Another one of my, you know, when I got into college, my father was like, look, like my other two cars had kind of died. And he's like, look, you need another job. Like go get it if you want another car. So I ended up like working in a pool hall, Smith's Pool Hall in downtown, one of the oldest pool halls in the country. And I kind of started in there as like a little bit of a bouncer. And then the manager of the restaurant downstairs liked me and let me get behind the bar. There was a little tiny bar up there. And I got going. And next thing I knew, I was making a good living bartending at that time. And so when Boston College ended, I went up to a beach resort in New Hampshire, and I'd worked with this woman, you know, 2 or 3 years prior, who I just loved. She was like another mother to me. And I just started working, and I was making a busload of money, you know, $300 to $400 a night when I was working. And I would sit up with her every night afterwards, and we would count the till and just talk. And she said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do with your life?" I said, "You know what, Sylvia? I don't know." I said, "I love athletics, and I think I want to coach and like try to win a championship someday." And we were drinking 2 big Tanqueray and tonics at the time out of pint glasses. And she got up, she gave me a big kiss. She said, "You fired?" I said, "Yeah, right." She goes, "Finish counting the money, put the till away, and we'll talk tomorrow." So I had a shift the next night, and I came in, and there was some girl behind the bar. I was like, "Who are you?" And she's like, I'm Jennifer, and Sylvia said for you to go upstairs. And I said, "No, I'm working tonight." She's like, "You got to go upstairs and see Sylvia." So I went upstairs. I said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Tonight's a big money night." She said, "You're going to sit in that chair, and we're going to write letters to coaches." And she said, "We're going to mail them off. And if we get that done, I'm going to let you continue to work." And so at the time, I struggled to put words together and articulate correctly. And she helped me write this letter. And she said, you know, at the time I wanted to see big time college football. So we found the strength coaches at Penn State, at Tennessee, at Clemson, at Florida State, at West Virginia. And she typed this letter with a typewriter and sent it out. And sure enough, I like 2 weeks later, I heard back from Bruno Paletto at Tennessee and with a handwritten note. And then I got a call from Clemson and Gary Wade. And these guys said, "Hey, can you interview for a position? That we have a GA position." I said, "Sure." So I went to my first NSCA conference in Las Vegas. And I met Bruno Paletto. And then Gary Wade invited me down to spend a visit in South Carolina. And I went down, and one of my buddies was a GA there that played football with me in college. And so during the interview, we hit it off, and he said, "You know, when can you come?" And I said, "Well, when do you need me?" And this was like on a Wednesday. He said, "Can you be here next Monday?" And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, look, I'm worried that I might not be able to get into the graduate school." You know, I said, and I knew who I was at the time. And he said, "Look, there's a graduate degree that you're not going to have to take the GRE, and it's, you know, counseling. And it would be, you know, you could pick an emphasis on what you wanted to do." He said, "But I think we can get you in." And at Tennessee, I was going to have to take the GRE to try to get a nutrition degree. And so I flew back home, and I told Sylvia, I said, "This guy offered me a job." She said, "You're leaving." I said, "I don't want to leave." She said, "You're leaving." She said, "Pack your things. You're going, you're going to take this job." So I, under my mattress, I had like $8,600 in cash. And I went and I got a duffel bag, and I bought my ticket, and I flew to South Carolina. I didn't have a car. And I spent a couple of nights with my buddy, and then finally found a place, and I had to hitchhike to get into work, you know, when I first started. And I was making $11,000 a year. And then sure enough, Rick Barnes came in and took the basketball job over in the spring. And I was working with basketball at the time. And he said, "Hey, you know, I know you love football." He said, "But why don't you come over and be my full-time basketball guy?" And I said, "Well, tell me about the job." And he's like, "Well, I can't pay you." And I said, "Well, that's a rough way to start the conversation, you know." And he's like, "But this is what I'll promise you." He said, "I'll promise you that you can go anywhere in the world and anywhere in the country to get better. And he said, you can buy any book, any video. He said, I promise you, I won't let administration hold you back from learning. I said, really? He's like, yep. And he said, and you and I will win a national championship someday. And at that time, I was really like, I just wanted to win. I wanted to be a part of something that, a machine that learned how to win. And so I took the deal and I started going everywhere. I was, you know, going and spending a week with Mark Versteeg, and I had every video Mike Boyle did. I had Vern Gambetta's, you know, course. I flew to see Gary Gray. I was on the move, and I was acquiring all this knowledge and information. But like, as a young coach, you don't know how to, you know, there's no principles. You're just seeing the exercises that you want to put into your program. And, but at the time, the coach asked me to, there's no desk for me. And so he's like, here, put a desk in this room. And it was like a lounge to the coach's locker room. And it's where he officed every day. So he hated his office. He would come in and watch film and get on the phone and talk to commissioners and other coaches. And I was in the room the whole time. So all of a sudden I would start to, as he would watch tape, I would say, can I watch with you? He's like, yeah. So he started to really teach me the game of basketball when I was 23. And I was able to, you know, for 3 years, I'd lived in that office with him. Mm. And so I went to every video session that he had with the boys. I was in every meeting. And I started to develop this generalist view of learning, right? Like anything that I could do to help us win, learn the game, you know, strength and conditioning, rehabilitation. I would come back and do treatments with the guys at night. I was all in. And at that time, I had shared with you, I was all over the place a little bit. I needed someone to have a major influence in my life. And this guy did. He was a young coach, 38 years old. I was 23. And he taught me how hard you had to be, how disciplined you had to be to certain routines if you were going to be successful. Mm. And really and truly, like, as I get older, and you know this too, the best high performers in the world, they're committed to certain routines, right? But how that looked for us as a team, you know, he made me think so far outside the box. Instead of just being a strength coach, it was like, how could we recruit, right? Like, I started to learn about recruiting. I started to learn about the nuances of defense, and we started to develop these speed drills that we could rehearse our defensive movements, you know, 12 months a year instead of just when the preseason started. So the majority of our conditioning was all these closeout drills to help side across, to recover, crossover. And so that was just an amazing experience for me at a young age to have this young coach teaching me the game. And then just anything that I could do to help our program be better. And then on top of traveling and learning from all these other people, it was just such an amazing opportunity at that time, you know?
Do you ever wonder if Sylvia hadn't kicked you out, what you would have become or where you would have gone?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. No, there's a lot of times. And this is, it's such a great story. It really is. And mm-hmm. I lost Sylvia my third year of coaching. She ended up passing away of cancer. And still to this day, it's been over 25 years. I send flowers to the bar on the day she passed away, which is May 2nd. Mm-hmm. And I've never missed a day. The bar closed down 4 or 5 years ago, and her daughter opened up an inn in New Hampshire. And I send the flowers there now. But it's just, that's how much it means to me that you just never know when someone's going to have that pivotal, you know, that they're going to have that much of an impact in your life. And there's no doubt without her at that time, I was just making so much money that I probably, you know, I would have hung out with my buddies and I would have kept bartending and I don't know what would have happened, you know?
What do you think she saw in you that you didn't see in yourself?
You know what? She had a daughter that she absolutely loved. I think that she treated me like a son that she had never had. Mm. And like, you understand teams, like there's, you have your family at home, but there's something special about what she created as this owner of this bar. Like you just wanted to work harder for her. Right. It was like, and everybody came there because of her, just how she treated customers. And so she instilled in me, you know, the connecting part, right? Like if I could walk into a bar at nighttime and look down and there's seven different personalities there, if I wasn't able to get to those personalities, I wasn't going to make money, nor was I going to move drinks for her. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you, like, I'm learning about what it feels like to create this family driven entity. Mm-hmm. And then you're learning about how to connect with people and get the best out of the atmosphere that you're involved in, you know?
How did her overture to you inform your work with interns, that guys that intern under you? Do you look for the intangibles in the people that work with you over time, kind of recognizing who they are, what they want to achieve? Quick break here, and we'll be back in a couple of seconds with our podcast guest. I've often been asked, how do I do what you do? What books or courses should I take? And for a long time, I had no real answer to that question. Delivering the concepts and practices we now call reconditioning was this compilation of so many ideas, concepts, methods, and strategies. But 7 years ago, Jamie and I set out to answer that very question by creating one systematic process that would help you bring it all together and supercharge the skills and systems you already know. You see, reconditioning is not about excluding anything. No, it's about being inclusive, holistic, proactive, and curious. It's about having an operating system that grows with you and supports you in your human performance practice. We want you to be the reconditioning professional everyone wants to work with, so you can determine your value and explore the possibilities of success. For more information about becoming a reconditioning professional today, head over to www.reconditioninghq.com and download the free video explaining our powerful 5 R's practice for improving mobility. A new era of performance training is upon us. Maximize your isometric endurance strength and functional performance with the all-new ISOFIT MSK. No matter what your sport, ISOFIT will help best prepare your body to tolerate the forces associated with it. This not only reduces your chances of sustaining career-limiting injury, it will also enhance your ability to perform at your highest level. I really like what Brad Thorpe and ISOFIT are doing, and I encourage you to learn more about their mission by visiting www.isofit.ca. So isofitmsk.ca today. And remember to use the discount code LEAVEYOURMARK, three separate words, to save $500 off your ISOFIT MSK purchase. Matrix Fitness is about performance innovation, and I'm proud to have them with me on the Leave Your Mark podcast. They recently named my good friend and awesome performance coach, Mark Fitzgerald, as their head of performance team, which is a bold statement for anyone who wants to know they're working with the best. Matrix has all kinds of interesting lines of equipment. The Matrix Glute Trainer addresses the discomfort, inefficiency, and danger of working with loaded barbell during hip thrusts. The Matrix Glute Trainer accommodates resistance bands and weight resistance and is customizable to different body types and sizes, endorsed by many and comes at a cost below others on the market. The Matrix S-Drive is a sprint performance treadmill that supports sprint training, resisted sled pulls, and pushes all on the frame of a standard treadmill. The 7 feet by 3 foot footprint of the S-Drive is non-motorized and is perfect for coaches who do not have access to a track or want to provide coaching in real time with the athlete. The non-motorized feature and flexibility in a simple machine keeps benefits high and investment low. For more information or a free consult, go to teamupwithmatrix.com/CA today. We're back. Enjoy the rest of this podcast.
Yeah, no, I always... you know, now that I'm lucky to lead, there's certain things that you value as in your leadership spot. I value people that are connectors, that they can connect, right? Like if you can connect with an athlete and the compliance for them to come in and work is high, right? I do want our people to be very competent, right? That they have a high level of skill, that they love what they do. You know, there's a bunch of C's that fall into this category. On this interview in LA, I learned from Doc Rivers, we were actually having this conversation on, you know, things that we value. And I was talking about the connection and the competency and the competitiveness. Like, I wanted people that were competitive, that they want to win. They want to be a part of an organization that wins, not that you just showing up for a job. And I said, what do you value, coach? And he gave me another C, which is it was brilliant. He said, I need people to cooperate. He said, I want really smart people that are competent, but like, if we can't cooperate and work together, he goes, you're always going to be limited as a team. Mm-hmm. And so I think you and I had engaged in a conversation, like, I want really smart people in our team, but can we play in the sandbox? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, whatever is the stakeholder that gets to make the decision, that's what the decision is. And can you still do your job at a high level and be okay and walk out the door and be okay with that? Mm-hmm. But without a doubt, Sylvia instilled in me the ability to see people that are great connectors, great communicators, right? They just know how to make people, they could loosen them up and engage and talk, and therefore the athlete will pick the phone up, you know, at the end of the day, if they call. And usually those people are the ones that can tell them the truth, right? And that's what, at our level, you know, we have to be able to have uncomfortable discussions in order to be able to move the performance needle. And so that's why I value the connectedness part that Sylvia probably taught me at that young age.
Awesome. I really like the thread too on, you were talking about the coach that you were working under and learning the game. And, you know, I have similar viewpoints around, you know, how the gym serves the game and how the game serves the gym and how they are interconnected, rather than being, I think sometimes the industry from an educational standpoint tends to silo it a little bit too much, to the degree that it's, you know, you're bigger, faster, stronger, and this is what you learn to do. It sounds like in your pedigree, that sort of, I guess, bias was broken relatively early in your recognition of how the game serves the gym and how the gym serves the game. Maybe talk about that a little bit, and how you've recognized what you can shape in the gym to make a better basketball player or a better athlete in general.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, what I love about what you're doing, I started to look into your course a little bit and get on. You know, training, it's on a spectrum, right? And there's the training room, and then there's the performance room, and then how do you get it into the final, like, competitive play, right? But our worlds are all kind of blending together. And so, like, how can you be a leader in the space to help the communication from training room to, as they crisscross, right? Like, who's doing what skills? And then how the performance room starts to blend into the actual world of basketball. You know, I think that's where having that young coach at the time has allowed me to do what I'm doing now, is that you really get to understand the game of basketball and some of the performance disruptors or things that that players have to do better. And you can understand coach speak. Right? Like, oh, he has to get into the ball. You know, like, a strength coach might not necessarily know what exactly that means. Right? But I, like, just being around it and learning, like, the ability to put my body on the guy that's dribbling the ball so I can't get hit by a screen. Like, I know you talk about having a common thread of language, right? Like, and how important it is if we're going to function as a high team, as a high performance team. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right that in professional sports, it can get siloed. So all of a sudden, some of that nomenclature that happens on the floor, the performance team doesn't understand. Some of the nomenclature in the training room, right? Like, the, you know, the actual injury itself and the nomenclature that comes with that, the performance room doesn't really understand. Mm-hmm. And where I've been blessed is that my learning has allowed me just enough in the medical side and the basketball side to be a conduit to create better lines of communication between those areas. I say that I just know enough that I slept at a Holiday Inn, you know, and it's right. And it's just that you could hold a conversation in regards to something that's medical and something that's maybe basketball related. And maybe a little bit better than that. It's probably being a little, you know, humble on that, but it's, you know, I was lucky that one of the major influences on me, because I had some hurt players at Texas, was Gary Gray. And, you know, Gary Gray is an amazing physical therapist that runs the science of applied functional science. And so when I got to Texas, I was really a traditionally based power, you know, in the weight room, true power development. You know, we were Olympic lifting and things like that. And then my coach, when I took the job over, he wanted me to run a high intensity program. And so I ran that for a year or two. And then, but when we got to Texas, we had a group of guys that were, you know, five or six guys that were really talented, like three or four that were probably pros. And they had osteitis pubitis, you know, some severe ankle injuries, some things that I just didn't know how to fix. And so I hunted out Gary Gray. And I always remember I went to his first chain reaction seminar and I sat down and you know, he was talking about chain reactions of the biomechanical chain reaction of the foot. You know, when the foot hits the ground, the calcaneus everts, the tip, the talus will fall down and in, the mid-tarsal joint will collapse. And I'm like, what? Like, what? What are you like? And I raised my hand. I remember I said, Gary, what is a calcaneus? And like the rest of the room, like just turned and looked back at me like, are you kidding me right now? Like, and I was like, yeah, well, like I paid $700 and I don't know what that is. So like, I'm going to ask the question. And Gary like fell in love with it instantly and like slowed it down for me and taught me it was the heel bone. And sure enough, we had some real issues with some great players that relationship that I struck up with Gary. We found some chain reaction biomechanic issues in some foot that were causing some back problems in some really, really good players that I had that we found solutions to, you know, once we mobilized this area, how the chain reaction would affect the SI joint on that side. And sure enough, so my traditional views of strength training, now all of a sudden I got new glasses on, right? And I'm thinking, if my job is to have these guys on the floor, like, you know, as a strength coach, you're torn, they got to look great. They got to move a ton of weight, you know, and you're getting caught up in this. You're like, no, like if this kid's on the floor and he's playing, you've done your job. And there's an evolution to training, right? Like eventually you'll get past that. You can move into these other skills in your toolbox to make this player better. So Gary's world started dragging me into the restoration component of, you know, more on those lines of the medical world. And then I'm developing these skills with my coach and I'm in the middle. And looking back now, those were both pivotal moments in my career to help me gain knowledge and just look at human performance through a different lens than I was. You know, your players, they influence you how you look at it, especially when you're not creating a solution for their issue. And then the people that we're lucky to go learn from, you know, all of a sudden you'll be sitting there, someone will say something and you're like, yeah, like that one makes a lot of sense to me right now, but I don't quite totally understand it, but I need to dive into it. And that's what Gary really did for me too.
Is there a player in your career that you worked with that, and you don't have to name names, but I'm more interested in the story that maybe taught you more about yourself than you taught them in some sense?
Oh, yeah. No, like what I really started to learn at Texas, once we started to, we were really lucky. We at Texas, we started to really recruit some really great players, but I'll share with you we were in a year that we had a really good team, and I had a great rebounder and defensive player that had a low back issue. And I'm bridging him and stabilizing his pelvis. But I do notice that when he runs, his left arm won't throw back. It stays like almost Velcroed to his side. You could see that pattern, right? And his back is just killing him. And this kid will do anything for me. So I'm telling him that, you know, we're going to stabilize this. We're going to get it right. And he's like, all right, coach, you know, like, just get me right. And I don't know what I'm doing, you know. And I use the analogy, like, you hear something's wrong under the hood of your car. And, like, you open the hood up and, like, you wiggle the spark plug and, like, you look, check the battery cable. But really, you have no idea what you're doing under the hood of the car, right? Just shut the hood and go learn about the engine. And that's where I really felt like with this kid, I was really humbled by it. And I went to Gary and I was like, Gary, like, what's going on? And he's, you know, I fly him to Colorado and he says, like, look at his right heel. And I'm looking at the right heel and I'm thinking, well, look at the left heel. And I could see the right heel's really bent over. Like it's really inverted. Right. And so as he's walking, you could see he's not swinging the left arm. Like it's the left arm's like kind of Velcro to the side. And he says, yeah, no, it's his heel. And I said, Gary, you don't get it. Like his back hurts. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, no. Like his back hurts. Like, why is his back hurt? He's like, yeah, no, it's his heel. And I'm like, what? And he's like, look, if you loosen this up, this is what happens in chain reaction biomechanics. Calcaneus is going to dive in, tib fib. You're going to get internal rotation to the femur, and you're going to load these big, powerful muscles on the front part of his hip. He said, but diagonally, his left arm's not swinging back because if he throws it back, he's going to go right through the discs. He says he doesn't have the motion to create a chain reaction through an anterior chain reaction through the front hip to stabilize his pelvis. I'm like, you got to teach me. So he teaches me the mobilization and how to put him in these transformational zones. And sure enough, something that I had been banging my head 6 months, we had fixed in less than 4 weeks. Shortly after that, I recruit a great player out of high school who's going to go to the NBA, but he has a spondylolisthesis in the right side of his low back. So when I get him, I take his shoes off and I'm looking at his feet and I notice these HV bunions that are pretty significant, right? Which usually they wouldn't scare me, but when I go to push the right one back, it won't go back at all. Like he has no dorsiflexion in the first ray whatsoever. So I get him up and try to squat him out of the right ankle. He's got no dorsiflexion out of the right ankle. And this kid runs like a deer at 7 feet. So just imagine the last thing that comes off the ground in gait would be his big toe, but he can't. So he toes open to get through the hip. And now the pelvis is spinning back twice as fast and he breaks the facets at L4, L5. So Gary teaches me how to, and now this kid, like I get into his feet and he's like, hey man, it's my back. And I was like, yeah, no, I get it. Like, I just had this conversation a couple of months ago. So we get into the toe, get some more dorsiflexion into it, get it where we can load it into a position that it looks like he's running in the transformational zone. That one takes a little bit longer. But now that kid went on to play 15 years in the NBA and made over $150 million, right? Mm-hmm. So now I'm like, okay, there's something to this. And then I'm really lucky that a couple years later, I get Kevin Durant, right? We get Kevin. Kevin, this is where I really start to change how I think about performance training for basketball. If you look at all the greatest players that have played the game, they are masters of this space. The game of basketball, well, in most any athletics, it's all about who wins the space, right? But you have a guy across from you. How can I use my body to create a competitive advantage to win the space? And so, like, you're looking at Kevin, like, can't even bench press the bar when you get him. I can't, you know, everybody's teaching us the overhead squat. This is a true measurement of athleticism. You know, he can't even break in his waist, right? Like, and you're like, wow, like, this is going to be a lot. And then you go upstairs and you watch him play basketball, and his ability to use the ground to get into a body, his ability to stop and accelerate and decelerate, to get back out and be balanced in space. you're really realizing like it's about vector-based movement. So as I start to get Kevin and TJ Ford and all these other great, great players, I'm like, maybe we need to train on the vectors a little bit more than just with our feet in place. Because the best, you know, skill acquisition is all about, you know, how can you influence, put as many influences in that you could execute the skill repetitively, you know, with efficiency, right? But if you change the footwork under how you shoot a ball, right? So I start to think maybe we should train on these vectors a lot more than I start to value lunging and leaping and shuffling and the intermediate locomotion patterns, right, that these guys are doing. And if I can create a more robust nervous system and understanding how to accelerate, decelerate out of these vectors, maybe we could help these guys more. And sure enough, that's where the evolution to the training system starts to, it starts to change a little bit. Instead of just squatting in place, we start to lunge and lunge out of loads and loading with bungees. And then at that time, I'm diving into the fascial system, you know, and so you're learning about how this connective tissue, its qualities of the viscoelasticity to it and how it can disperse movement through the tensegrity unit. You know, I'm researching a ton into Thomas Myers at the time and David Lasondak, who's been a major influence in me in understanding connective tissue and fascia. But just basically Davis's law, right? Like in the concept of mechanotransduction, that by the lines of force that we as coaches decide to move these athletes in, they're going to lay down lines of collagen and create a more robust omnidirectional fascial system. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm learning this fascial system. Gary's teaching me the three-dimensional movement and how to, through that three-dimensional movement, how we can influence Davis's law and mechanotransduction. And so once again, the lens that I'm looking at training starts to even evolve again. I got to take these off and put another set on, you know? But those guys were big time influences on me because some of the best players that I've ever coached, they haven't been very good at traditional training, you know, the way that it was defined for us growing up, you know, the clean, the squat, the bench, you know, and in the bio, you said I was lucky to coach two national players of the year. Both those guys got pinned at the combine under 185 and they were national players of the year. Like Kevin, I think in the combine testing might have finished like the bottom five. And so like now you start to think, how are we defining an athlete?
Right.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you've probably had great, like just guys that can win their space, you know, and use the puck and the stick to deceive the guy across from him to pull the puck back and make a pass or make a shot. Those guys really changed how I thought about training.
That's cool. I love that. I'm going to use that moment to segue to your purpose in life, which I get from my book called The Day You Were Born that was written by an astrologer named Linda Joyce. So when I first read it, I was a little struck by it, but I think after hearing what you said about your youth, it may make a little bit more sense. But anyways, you're an Aries 8, born March 26th. Your purpose is to learn the process of success step by step, mastering the technical while never losing touch with your passion. Always do what you're afraid to do, Emerson. This is the energy of blocks and breakthroughs. If you stay blocked long enough, you'll have a nervous breakdown or a breakthrough. Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman on the Supreme Court in its 208-year history. Diana Ross, March 26, crossed boundaries of race and age with her music. The Aries 8 dynamic is about living the spiritual life in alignment with the ego's needs. Control is an issue for these people, and so is their acute ability to scrutinize the situation in themselves. They strive for perfection and drive themselves and everyone else crazy. This prevents their talents from emerging and drains their self-confidence. Their anger is turned inward, making them frustrated and giving them headaches. They erect impenetrable boundaries or have none at all and wish that someone would take care of them. Their world can only be as large as they can manage by themselves. They have so much to offer if they can just access their faith and have a little trust in the right people. They must learn to confront what's really bothering them. Aries eights is a great combination for analysis. There you go. I don't know if any of that.
I'm sure my wife didn't write that. You know, the astrology part is something, I'll share this quick story with you. My wife's family is big into it. Huge. I must have been in my early 30s. No, I was in my late 20s. No, early 30s. And they would get their cards read all the time over the summer on vacation. Like, just do it, you know? And I was like, I don't believe in it. Like, I'm not doing it, you know? And so sure enough, they're all sleeping one day, and I sneak across the street, and I do the cards. And this lady, you know, she tells me three pivotal things that are supposed to happen. And she talks about my sign. And you know, at that time, then I start to learn, you know, you have a rising sign, right? So you got two signs. You get that, and then when you're born, that year, that exact time, the moon's in a particular place that gives you a second sign. Mm-hmm. So I'm an Aries Scorpio rising. My wife is an Aries. She's a Leo rising. Well, usually two Aries wouldn't be very compatible. The best leaders are my best friends in my life. They're all Leos. I don't know why, but they just happen to fall into that week of August. It's really, really strange. But I get the cards read anyway. And she tells me that she sees a child coming. And we had two girls at the time. And at that time, we were having trouble having the third. I had some issues going on that I was going to probably have to get fixed. And I was like, you're crazy. And then she's like, you're going to meet this person on September, whatever it was. It was a date. So I write these things down and I leave. Sure enough, like 3 months later, we get pregnant with my son. And then I actually end up meeting someone that's really pivotal in my life around the time that she said. So then I'm like, all right. So I start looking into the astrology part and reading it. Now, I went back a couple other times and they were way off, like nothing ever happened. But it was just enough for me to start to learn, pick up a book about astrology and start to read. What you just did read about me is a lot of it is very accurate. The one thing that I'm most proud of is that I think I've really realized my strengths and my weaknesses, and that I've really been authentic and humble to what I've been in settings that could be very overwhelming, to ask the right questions and not be afraid to, you know, that I maybe might have looked like I wasn't as qualified as what I should be, but I knew that I didn't know the information. I knew if I wanted to go where I had to go, that I had to learn it. And so I wasn't afraid to slow down seminars and ask and have the courage to, and the humbleness to ask, right? And a lot of us can get around these people that they're really smart, right? And it can be intimidating. But I look back at what you just read. I was definitely determined that I wanted to try to get to live the dream, you know, and manifesting that vision of what it looked like. And it wasn't all just work. Like, you know, I'm crazy in love with my wife, and I'm going to go on 25 years with her next week. And I got three amazing kids, but work, I was really driven to I was crazy curious to just how to learn how to help people be better. And it wasn't always about just the physical part. It was about, you know, the emotional intelligence, you know, could I read on interactions with people? And I've just always been, you know, fascinated with those, I can learn that all day long. Mm-hmm. You know, you drop me in front of a physics class and I'm going to struggle. But, and so what you just read, I feel like, is pretty accurate, you know?
Mm. Well, in that regard, you meet this woman, Kate, and you just mentioned you're madly in love with her. What is her yin to your yang? What is she balance in you or insight in you or define?
Yeah, no, you know, I can be a pretty intense personality. and a really strong personality. She's a love. Oh man, this girl, she's a love. And my kids are, they're a great extension to her, but her empathy, you know, her ability to not be judgmental. But she's really made me believe that I can do what I've done. Like, there's been times where, you know, in that Aries thing where you could see sometimes you could waver, and, you know, my wheels never stop turning, and it's a problem because I don't sleep very well because of it. But she's always been there when I've hit those times that maybe I've wavered. She's like, no, you got this and you can do this. So she's been, you know, she's been everything to me, and that truth be known, I wouldn't be where I'm at without her. She's made me believe. There was a time when we got let go at Texas, and I was like, I'm just going to do Train for the Game. Like, I can be around the kids more, and I can be around you more. And she's like, yo, like, I love you, and I know how much you love our children. She's like, but, like, you're not ready to stop coaching. She's like, I'm scared for you if you stop. Like, it's just like, it's just who you are. It's like what you do. She's like, maybe we should try to take this next opportunity and then reevaluate. And she was dead on. Like, I just wasn't ready to stop. And then getting out of the college world and moving into the NBA, like, there was just a huge growth. Like, you're learning new skills, and you're moving your family all the way. You know, all my kids were born and raised in Austin, Texas. They were there 17 years. Like, the world of change that came through, it was just an epic opportunity for growth, you know, for my children too, like my wife, all of us. And then we got this other opportunity that it took us even to another level, you know. But she's everything to me. She keeps me balanced. You know, she's got a way, like, sometimes she'll just have to look at me, you know, like, you're being a jerk right now, you know, like, you need to pull the reins back a little bit.
And what do the kids do for you?
You know what, you know, having one yourself, genetics is a beautiful thing. You know, my oldest one looks like me and she is my wife. You know, my middle one looks like my wife and has a little bit of bite to like me. My son looks a lot like me, but he's got blonde hair like my wife, and is just like, he's a really smart kid. You know, he's got an entrepreneurial spirit to him. He's got some of that work ethic that I shared earlier with you. Like, he's just always finding ways to make money. And, so it's been cool. My wife's done the majority of it. You know, I'd be lying if I said that, you know, you know, Scott, like, our demands as coaches, it takes us away a lot. And the one, you know, the guilt that I have being away from my children, it's real. You know, it's a real thing that that can be complex at times to navigate. But she encourages me that I'm teaching my kids to go do something that they love, right? They're watching their dad do something that they love. And then when I am there, my wife makes sure that I'm present, though, you know, that I'm going to be dialed in. So, if,
you know, for younger people, you know, a lot of times younger coaches aspire to work in professional sport and get the jobs that you and I have had, et cetera. And I'm just curious if you can distill down and not wax too philosophic, but almost find words to describe, what would you say it is and it isn't for the young person listening? What is it and what isn't it, so they understand it a little bit more?
You know, really, if I'm going to drill down to the simplest form, is I use this phrase, cannonball catcher, right? Like, it's problem solving. And either you're a solution or you're a problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what a lot of people don't understand is that how hard you have to work to actually get to where we've had the opportunity to get to, and how hard you have to continually be developing your skills to get there. But the bottom line is, are you good at what you do? And can you connect with athletes, and can you cooperate? Can you play in the sandbox? If you have those three qualities, you have an opportunity to actually be successful. But you really have to be a problem solver. Performance is all about problem solving. It's about evaluating what the athlete needs. It's about energy, right? Like, how are you cultivating energy for the athlete? And you have, it's the aggregate of marginal gains in all these categories of nutrition, sleep, communication, right? Mental mindset. You're trying to develop all these little, how can you educate these people? That's what it is. What it isn't, it's not as glamorous as it may appear. You know, like, oh, you get to work with professional athletes. Oh, really? Like, you haven't seen us land at 4 o'clock in the morning for 10 days in a row going from one city to the next to the next. You know, you haven't watched us 72 days in the bubble, you know, and going back to our same hotel room every single night. And, you know, there's some things to this job that are not easy. It's not easy. And so the attitude that you enter into the building every day, and the, you know, my first year in Philadelphia, they told me we would be one of the historically one of the worst teams ever in the history of the NBA. There was a potential for that. And I had come out of winning for so long. And what I really learned that year is there's a difference between losing and being a loser, right? And that's like the energy and the attitude that I can bring into my room on a daily basis to affect my guys. What we do is really hard. And you have a choice, though, when you enter the doors, whether you're going to be good or great, you know, and how that, as a leader especially, can trickle down to the rest of the organization in your space. But it's not as glamorous as what it may look like. There's a lot of physical things that are really demanding. They takes away from your family quite a bit. There's some major sacrifices that go into it, you know. It's actually an awesome question, you know.
Yeah, well, it's important, you know, to cover that item, because, and it's one of the things that I try to from time to time with the podcast when I talk to guys like yourself, because like I said, those aspirations are, you know, nobody should squelch those or limit those aspirations for anybody, but you should also understand what you're getting yourself into. It's, I call it the big shiny red sports car. You understand you want to buy a Ferrari, but you also have understand you have to pay for it. You have to put it in the garage. Sometimes it doesn't run so well. There's lots of different things that you need to consider before you go and buy it.
That's a good analogy.
Last question. If you were to switch seats with Sylvia on that night back many years ago, what would you say to yourself?
You know what? I just feel really blessed that it happened the way that it happened. You know, she, and at the time I was making her a lot of money. Like, I was probably a better bartender than I was, than I've ever been a coach. But the unconditional love, right, that she showed me in that moment to let me go. And we were really close too. So like, you know, to learn that when someone has an opportunity, no matter how much you love them, you might want to push them towards that direction. You know, that's probably the biggest lesson that I took from it. No matter how much you love them and the interactions with them, if they have an opportunity that you know that they have a chance to grow and live their dream, that you got to move them into that direction, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful story, Todd. I really, really like that story. So thanks for sharing that with me.
And yeah, thank you, man.
I don't know if you share it much in your speaking engagements, but if you don't, I think you should, because it's really something that it stands out about, maybe really part of who you are. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. I appreciate the encouragement there.
Thank you for your time today. It was really been nice to get to know you a little bit better, and hopefully it's not the last time our paths will cross, and I look forward to seeing you again.
No doubt, man. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Pain, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.